Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we welcome back Rachel Louise Snyder, author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. When Rachel Louise Snyder was on earlier this month, we had a huge response from listeners, and so we decided to invite her back to spend some more time exploring what can be done to solve the issue of domestic violence, which one in four women and one in nine men experience. And one of the questions she asks in her book is whether violent men can be taught to be nonviolent. She says we can't expect every program to work the first, second, or even the third time, but we have to keep trying. And she focuses on a couple of programs. One is Resolve to Stop the Violence. It's a program that started in a San Bruno jail with perpetrators of domestic violence. San Bruno is just south of San Francisco. The program's graduates are 80% less likely to be arrested for reoffending than inmates who did not participate. Researchers found that once offenders were released back into their communities, if they'd gone through the program in its entirety, they often became voices of nonviolence. And Rachel interviewed men who were part of that program. Rachel Louise Snyder is associate professor at American University. She's written for many publications, including The New Yorker and The Washington Post. And she joins us again from NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Hi, Rachel. Thank you for coming back.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here again.
Well, it's great to have you. And, you know, after we finished our show with you last time, we got so many phone calls. We didn't even have time to take all of them. And I really wanted to take all the calls. And so we did not get to the parts of your book that focused on these anti-violence programs. And I was really struck by this because I feel like when I read stories about domestic violence, they don't often go into these programs and talk about, you know, why men hurt women or kill women or treat women in the ways that you describe in your book. And it's such an important part of the story. Why did you decide to focus an entire section on men and these anti-violence programs?
Well, exactly what you said. We don't hear those stories. And when we don't have a full sort of picture of the story from every angle, then we're missing all kinds of information. I mean, I felt like to have those voices deleted from the story means that we don't progress. We are only dealing with the situation in its aftermath rather than in its origin. And so I knew it would be really difficult to cover as a journalist, especially a female journalist. I didn't know if anybody would be willing to really be honest and talk to me. But I just felt like it was so, so important. And I felt like it was equally important for me to kind of come at these stories with as open a mind as I could have, right? With empathy and with no judgment, just seeking the true representation of their experience.
We're going to talk about these programs. One I mentioned, there's another one, Man Alive. When you started doing the research for these programs and thought about actually interviewing the men, just talk about what that process was like. How did you go about finding the programs? How did you go about accessing the jail and interviewing the men?
Well, it's not easy, as you can imagine. There's all kinds of confidentiality issues and things like that. And, you know, there's reticence on the part of the men. But there's also people who are involved in these who really want these stories to get out, who want to be able to say, look, we're down in the trenches and we're trying really hard to address this. And so the first batterers intervention program or offenders intervention program I sat in on was outside of Boston. And I came to that program through domestic violence advocates who were working together with that program, which was begun by a man named David Adams. And, he was happy to have me sit in on what they were doing because it's so important. And it was really profound for me because I always thought that I would be able to, you know, I'm educated, I'm a feminist. I always thought, oh, I'll be able to identify an abuser and never myself be in one of those situations where I'm a victim. And that very first time I sat in on that group, it sort of really unsettled me, because it was seven men. They ran across the demographic, racial and economic gamut. And they were nice. They were funny. They were gregarious. Like, I'd have gone out for a beer with any of them. And I thought, oh my God, you know, this is why we picture a rageaholic, but that's not accurate, right? These are men who know perfectly well how to act. And I sat in on that first group as they deconstructed their fathers and their fathers' relationships with their mothers. And six of the seven had come from abusive households. Their fathers were abusive. And only one of those six identified his father as abusive. The other five all said, well, you know, my father wouldn't have had to have done that if my mother wouldn't have, you know, brought it on or egged him on or whatever. They excused the behavior of their father and rationalized the abuse while, you know, sort of demonizing their mothers, which I thought was really deeply unsettling and interesting.
You know, and these statistics are really important to talk about. In your book, you also write that 50% of boys in foster care are sexually assaulted. What are some of the other stats that we need to know about, you know, perpetrators and what sort of household childhood they grew up in, and if they were either saw domestic violence or they were also victims of some kind of abuse and violence?
Well, there are stats that say between 80 and 90% of men imprisoned today are either the witnesses or victims of child abuse and sexual abuse in their own households when they were kids. And, you know, that's important because it doesn't excuse what they do as adults, but it contextualizes it. And in a sense, it gives us a roadmap to be able to say, aha, this is where we need to address our efforts then in childhood, right, with really young people. So that's one of the most shocking statistics, is to learn that so many of them grew up in homes where this was normalized, and so they become adults in which it's normalized and the cycle continues.
And I should say, for some listeners, this show might be triggering. It might not be appropriate for children if you're listening with any kids. Just to put that out there, like we did in the last show, can we spend a little bit of time on this child abuse? Because, you know, I feel like in so many cases, there's so much going on in the country right now, and we've got so many problems, but we tend to kind of ignore some problems. We don't really go that deep. And child abuse in the United States is at epidemic levels. I mean, I remember reading 5-10 years ago, The Guardian did a long piece about child abuse in the United States. What would it take to actually, well, first we have to have a conversation about this and then really tackle it. Because as you say, it's not to say, well, this person was abused, and so we have to let them off. But what if we tackle the problem when it happens? What if we grab some of these people when they were young, so, you know, that we could try to break the cycle? I mean, these are really big issues, but can you talk about that?
They are, yeah. And I can talk a little bit about it. The book has limitations when it comes to this, but I will say that some of the, for example, this program I sat in Cambridge, it was called Emerge. They have what's called offender accountability classes, but they also have parenting classes that sort of run right alongside those. And that seems to me really an important aspect of trying to give people who abuse their spouses or their children an alternative skill set, an alternative set of behaviors. The RSVP program, Resolve to Stop the Violence in the San Bruno Jail, does some of that as well. Like, you can't just say to people who are used to, you know, experiencing their emotions violently, stop doing that. It's wrong. This is what you look like. This is how you come across. You can't do all that without offering an alternative set of behaviors. And so batterers intervention programs get a lot of they're controversial because their efficacy is questioned, and we're right to question that efficacy. I mean, social science is an imperfect science, and I think in some ways that particular aspect of social science, meaning men who batter or women who batter and how to stop it, is really in its infancy in terms of how long we've been studying it. But to my view, if you don't have alternative parenting curriculum, you're not going to be as effective, put it that way. I'm not going to say you're going to be entirely ineffective, but you're not going to be effective at ultimately breaking that cycle, because these things are so connected. Child abuse, domestic violence, you know, sexual assault, and really all types of violence. I mean, child abuse is one particular type of violence, but a child who grows up in an abusive home may have domestic violence tendencies or violent tendencies when he or she is an adult, but also all kinds of other challenges as well, mental health challenges and cognitive challenges and maybe other types of violence. So it really is in some ways the seed of all these other issues that we face as a society.
Today we're speaking with Rachel Louise Snyder about her book No Visible Bruises, and we're talking about anti-violence programs for men. And as she said, 80 to 90% of men in jail have either been victims of abuse or they have seen abuse in their own household. And I'd like to give out the phone number if you have any questions or comments for Rachel. And again, if you do have a story to share, last time she was on, we heard from so many of you who shared personal stories. And we didn't get to this section in the book, and I think it's just so important to talk about anti-violence programs. And so that's why we decided to invite her back. So if you have any questions about this aspect of domestic violence, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in any programs that are focused on anti-violence, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You go into great detail in the telling us about the Resolve to Stop the Violence program. Can you give us a little bit of background there? And again, this is a program that started in a San Bruno jail with perpetrators of domestic violence. Tell us about the background of this program.
It's an incredible background, actually. So there was a prison guard named Sunny Schwartz, a woman named Sunny Schwartz, who worked in the prisons long enough to see this cycle of violence repeat itself. So she began to see the sons and grandsons of men that had been in jail, and she just got so frustrated. And so she began to look for programs that could begin to address violence. And she took a little bit from programs that had begun, batterers intervention programs that had begun, for example, in Duluth, Minnesota, or Denver, Colorado. There's some well-known ones. And then she put her own programming together, got funding for it. This is in the late 90s, and started this program called Resolve to Stop the Violence. And she managed to convince the sheriff at the time that they needed to create an all domestic violence wing of the San Bruno jail, that every guy in there would have domestic violence as a perpetrator in some degree. It may not have been the inciting incident that landed him in jail, but that he had charges for domestic violence. And at the same time, she wanted to know if it worked. She was results driven, and she, by the way, she has a fabulous memoir herself that goes into this in greater depth called it has the word monster in the title. I'll think of it when I'm not trying to think of it, and then I'll let you know. But so she brought in researchers named from NYU, James Gilligan and Bandy Lee, and said, "Okay, I want to start this program, but I want you to assess it and tell me if it's successful." And she knew that domestic violence didn't happen in a vacuum, that it happened alongside of addiction issues or, other kinds of issues, you know, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. So the initial program was a year long, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. It's a little less than that now. It's about 5 hours a day, 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. But it maintains the same basic tenets. And the first third, the first 4 months, is really getting men to understand their and take accountability for their violence, what they look like in a moment of violence, what their bodies do, how they might appear intimidating. And a big part of them learning about this is restorative justice. So a victim will go in, not a victim of any of the men in the group, so someone unrelated, but a victim will go in, and they still have this on Wednesdays, and talk about what it was like for her. It's almost always a woman to live under this type of kind of terrorism, right? This terror, this fear of anticipated injury. And for most of these men, it's the first time they've really had a moment to see what they look like from the outside, to see how their violence affects somebody, to see what it means to be violent and the kind of ripple effect into the community. The second part of the program is really about gender education and cultural expectation. And the third part of the program is about giving them a different kind of skill set and behavioral set to deal with when they're in a violent situation. You know, you're not going to change somebody's chemical makeup, right? If someone feels their blood pulsing and their muscles clenched, they're still going to feel that. It's just that they may have a different set of behaviors. I had one guy tell me that one of the things he realized in going through the first 4 months was that he stepped into an act of violence in the moment, right? He deconstructed a moment of violence and realized, yeah, his blood pumped, his muscles clenched, his body kind of hunched over, and he would take a step toward his wife. And he said he just learned in that moment, when he would feel his adrenaline rushing, to take a step back instead of a step forward. And it was enough to kind of recalibrate his brain and his behavior. And it's just really profound, because a lot of these men learn what they look like. They learn how culture and society shapes them and shapes their expectations of both men and women. And it's really enlightening. I had there's a guy in the book that I follow for a while named Dante Lewis, who went through the program twice when he was in San Bruno and then became a facilitator when he got out after the second time he went through it. I won't give away what happens in the book, because he disappears and I have to go find him, and you know, but he's a great character, and he was so honest with me. He grew up in East Oakland in what he called Baghdad. He was a gangbanger. He had all these sort of social pressures around him, but going through this program, he talked in that sort of lingo of East Oakland, but then he would say things like, you know, by calling my girlfriend the B word, I was really dehumanizing her and taking away her sense of self. And so he had this real ability to have like emotional connection and emotional education that was really a direct result of his having gone through that program.
Even while he was in prison, he read the book Emotional Intelligence and started taking classes in psychology and sociology.
Yeah, he was really taken with the idea that he could have a future, but he was so realistic about what he was facing. I mean, he said to me, like, he was about 30 the first time I interviewed him, and he said, you know, the old self has so many more years than the new self, and so it was a constant battle. And he read incessantly. In fact, at one point he goes back into prison and I began sending him all kinds of books. You know, I sent him James Baldwin and you know, different kinds of I think education and different kinds of books that would speak to him. But he really wanted to help other men, but he was so he was facing so many things. I mean, he was broke, right? He was getting about $700 a month to live on in San Francisco as a facilitator of this program. As an intern facilitator, you get more once you pass through your internship. He had all of his old, you know, guys in his neighborhood that he'd grown up with who did not have this kind of new belief system. And so they were constantly trying to pull him back in to his old way of life. He had family issues that he was dealing with. So the constellation is profound, and you can't, I mean, you can give these guys all the education in the world, but if you're not putting resources into the transition between, you know, the relative coziness of the Resolve to Stop the Violence program, where everyone around you is going through the same curriculum, you know, and you don't have resources for them to go back into the community, it's really, really difficult. And yeah, he had a sense of himself as really swimming upstream, I think.
Well, let's go to a caller. We have an anonymous listener calling from Berkeley. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, you're on the air.
Okay. I'm calling from Berkeley, and I don't want to give my name because I feel that social stigma is, like, so huge. My husband was arrested last year for trying to strangle me, and they didn't prosecute him, and I told him that if he wanted to, that he should go get help, like psychological help, but there really wasn't a system for people who aren't prosecuted to get help for domestic violence. So how... You know, I'd like to know specifically, are there programs in the area that are not court assigned? And I'd like to say that this, I could tell you the background, that my husband's father was a huge abuser of many children, psychologically and physically, and his wives. So probably you can hear how nervous I am in my voice. But, you know, the other thing is that now we have a 14-year-old son. My husband no longer lives at home. But my son just sprouted up from being shorter than me to being taller than me, and he has been exhibiting just really negative, physically negative attacks on me. And I really want to get help for my son as well.
Yeah.
Can I ask?
There you go, the cycle of abuse.
Just real quick, if you don't mind answering, what is your son's relationship like with his dad?
Well, my husband is a very loving father. When he was very little, we co-slept, and I think, well, you know, children, they move around a lot in bed, and on occasion, my son would kick him in the groin, and my husband would wake up with this huge violent reaction, just over the top, and be, like, punching and screaming and, like, totally raged. And I could only put together that that was because he had such a terrible childhood that... But there really isn't a lot of negative physical... interaction between my son and my husband.
Well,
so,
thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for calling, and I have to say, normally
going to say, he witnessed my husband so many times doing the whole, you know, making a fist, retracting it, like, ready to punch me, and I think that that was really bad for my son to witness.
It is, because the physical abuse is only part of it. It's the coercion, the emotional abuse. I get asked this question a lot. People email me and they ask me for specific programming in their state. And my book was more comprehensive than that, so I don't know individual programs. However, you happen to be in the one area where I know a program, which is sort of miraculous. The Man Alive program is, the curriculum is developed, and they actually have centers all over. They're in Oakland, they're in San Francisco. I'm not sure specifically in Berkeley, but they're in Alameda County. They have developed curriculum called Woman Alive, developed curriculum called Teen Alive, and this is the same curriculum that the RSVP program uses in the San Bruno jail, except that it's developed for once a week, 2 hour or 3 hour time slot. So it's the same curriculum, and you can go to the Man Alive, I think it's manalive.com, go to their website, and you'll be able to find information about that. And, you know, it's part of the problem, I think, what the caller is talking about is that to compel someone to go when they're not court ordered is really difficult. Most of the batterers intervention programs do take volunteer participants, but very few people, you know, very few men will volunteer on their own if not court ordered. But it does at least give a resource. The other thing I would say to the caller is, I would call the guidance counselors at your son's high school, because my guess is that they do actually have some programming that might be voluntary or might be that you might just not be aware of. And it could be at a community center, maybe not directly at the high school, but there might be some other programming in addition to Teen Alive that I would get him in.
And Rachel, for people living outside the area, you said that there aren't that many programs, so it's a good thing that she lives in Berkeley. But what would you say to people who live outside of the area who have similar stories and would like to get some help, or at least some, maybe some counseling, expose their son possibly to a group setting where they can learn about violence and gender? And I mean, are there any other resources out there for people to look into?
There are many batterers intervention. I think there's more than 2,000 batterers intervention programs across the states. So most states have them. It's just that they're varying levels of efficacy. But there, you know, groups like Men Can Stop Rape. They have a teen program. There's another one whose name is eluding me right now. But if you go on Twitter and see Men Who Stop Rape, you'll see all the other programs. They all follow each other, right? Futures Without Violence is a San Francisco-based program. Duluth program, the Emerge program in Boston. These are all, you know, Duluth is out of Minnesota. But no matter what state people live in, they can go to these programs or to the National Clearinghouse and say, what resources are available in my area? The other thing I would say is, if you really are in an area where you can't find a batterers intervention group at all, you know, you can look for a therapist who is trauma informed, and I would use that terminology and say, you know, my child has witnessed abuse. I'm no longer in danger. However, I want to get some help from someone who has a background in, you know, maybe vicarious trauma, or someone who is trauma informed. If you're really in a rural area and can't find any resources at all.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling. And we will put these resources on our website at yourcallradio.org. And because of what you raised, it just gave me an idea that we should have some of these organizations on and maybe some young men and talk about this. So thank you so much for sharing your story. Today, we are speaking with Rachel Louise Snyder about her very important book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. And Rachel was on a couple of weeks ago, and we got so many phone calls. We did not get to the section of her book about these anti-violence programs. And so that's why we decided to call her back and ask her to join us. We're going to take a quick break. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss coverage of the plight of migrants crossing the Mediterranean from war-torn Libya to Europe. Since January, more than 400 migrants have died making that perilous journey. We will also talk about the long-term impacts of the Trump administration stacking federal courts with conservative judges. So far, 123 federal judges have been confirmed. That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea, or if you have a guest idea or feedback for us, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we are joined by Rachel Louise Snyder, author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Every year in the United States, more than 10 million women and men, overwhelmingly women, but men also, are victims of domestic violence. And today, we are talking about anti-violence programs. And if you have any questions or comments, you can be anonymous. And again, some of this content might be triggering, and some of it might not be, or really is not, for children, is not appropriate for children. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And let's go next to Tom in Alameda. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Why, good morning. While I was listening to the panelists speak, I couldn't help but think, and it may be tangential, that the president fits the profile of subject number one in profile and abusive personality, since he does have a emerging history of sexual violence. And now we see clearly child abuse at the border. And he's been a bully all his life, and he has obsessive compulsive impulsivity clearly exhibited by Twitter and a whole host. And now we're seeing an emerging picture of the Epstein friendship sexual trafficking underage girls case. But what I'm befuddled by is he doesn't seem to have any past history of trauma. So what's his excuse in this profile in being a bully and an abuser? Or is there something in his personal family history that we don't know?
Rachel, have you looked into that or thought about that?
Oh, I've thought about that many times.
Yeah, I'm sure.
In fact, I've thought about that so often, I, for my own survival, try to put it out of my mind a little bit, because it makes me so angry. And I think, what message is he given? Is he giving to young men today, right? That you can bully your way through to get whatever you want. I mean, I don't know what's in his background. There may well be child abuse in his background. I think his father was pretty domineering. None of it excuses his behavior. I mean, you know, the thing is, you can grow up in an abusive household, and that contextualizes some of your behavior as an adult, but it certainly doesn't excuse it. And I think you still need to take accountability for it, right? And the change, if there is going to be one, has to start internally. And I think that's one of the most difficult elements of getting someone who is violent to be nonviolent, is that they have to want to become nonviolent first. You can't compel them. You can't jail them until they want to become nonviolent, right? It just doesn't work. We can't arrest our way out of the situation. Unfortunately, we're going to have to endure this guy until hopefully 2020 and no further. But I do, as I'm with your caller, I'm really worried about the ripple effect of having someone who is so clearly a bully, but also have almost unlimited power. I mean, it's kind of perfect storm.
According to Business Insider, at least 24 women have accused Trump of sexual abuse and misconduct. There is a piece at The Guardian that I just skimmed, but if people want to read more, it's called Making the Man: To Understand Trump, Look at His Relationship with His Dad. It's by Michelle Dean, D-E-A-N. And I also, since he brought up Epstein, there is a video now going around of a young Trump and Epstein with a number of young women around them. They're just dancing and partying. And I wonder what you think of the Epstein case. And I was thinking about a question for you on this. And just today we're getting word that Epstein has been denied bail for sex crimes and possible rape. Prosecutors have opposed Epstein's proposal to stay in his mansion until guard under trial, saying he was seeking special treatment. I'm reading from the New York Times. What are your thoughts, Rachel, about men in power who get away with sexual abuse, rape, domestic violence? What explains this? I mean, obviously, in this case, they have lawyers behind them, hundreds of millions of dollars. They're surrounded by powerful people. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, it's funny that we're talking about this, because my father has been visiting. He lives in Arizona. He's pretty conservative, and he's been visiting me, and we've been sort of tiptoeing around this to some extent, because, you know, it's easy to condemn Epstein once he's been arrested, but where is the condemnation of, you know, what Newt Gingrich did back to his wife, right, for example, decades ago? Even back when I was a graduate student, when Clinton admitted to having an improper relationship with Lewinsky, and what so enraged me about that was that no one seemed to be talking about the fact that despite it being consensual, the power imbalance made it so suspect in terms of consent, right? And this is one of the things that bothers me so much, is that we have these conversations and we can look at someone like Epstein and say, oh, well, he's got wealth, he's got power, he's white, he's got all the privilege that goes along with that. And somehow we excuse that behavior. But someone who you know, is a person of color, doesn't have the means, you know, might land in jail for a decade or longer. I think that the reckoning is long overdue. I think that it is directly connected to a sort of the power of the Me Too movement, along with the backlash of the Me Too movement. You know, one of the things we talked about last time I was on the show was that domestic violence homicide since 2017 has 33% in this country. I don't think that's disconnected from these issues that we're talking about. And I'm thrilled that Epstein has been denied bail. I'm thrilled that the judge and the prosecution seems like they're not ready to let him off. But really, he's just one person, right? He's just one person in a sea of people who are getting away with this over and over and over again. And I think women's rage, women like me are just tired of it, right? We're just tired of it. We want something different.
I was just reading
lives.
The other day about John Forsimano, a 24-year member of the Newark Police Department, who was accused of gunning down his estranged wife and wounding her boyfriend on Sunday night. I think we talked about this last time you were on, but Shannon Watts, the founder of Moms Demand, I mean, if you follow her Twitter feed, she finds all of these cases of gun violence, and so many of them are around domestic violence. In many cases, Rachel, you cannot even keep up with all of this.
Right.
Because they happen
right, absolutely.
So frequently.
Yes. And of course, I follow Shannon. I follow Michelle Dean, too. Her work is phenomenal. You're naming all these women whose work I love. But yeah, I mean, I get Google alerts, and there's, you know, 7 or 8 every time I get an alert. And the link is so direct between, you know, this kind of toxic masculinity and the access to guns and the fetishization of money and power, and I would include white privilege in that too. And I think, you know, there's been no moment in our history where progress hasn't come at a great cost. The suffragette movement, the union movement, the civil rights movement, right? Even go all the way back to the founding of America. These all come at great cost. And I mean, it feels very much to me like we are in a moment like that. Like we are in a moment. You know, this is somewhat tangential, but one of the conversations I was having with my father this morning, he's Christian evangelical, and he talked about how Christians are losing their rights because of things like gay marriage. And I said to him, how does giving one right take away another right? And we had this kind of back and forth, and I said, here's the philosophical underpinning to these arguments, which to me are very gender driven. The male argument, this maybe I'm getting too wonky here, but the male argument says, in order for someone else to win, I have to lose. The female argument says, we all need to win and we need to be equal. Like those to me, these are simplifications, but those to me seem like fundamental differences of being in the world. And that is really one of the tensions that we're seeing today, that women are saying, we want equality. LGBTQ people, you know, transgender people, whatever, are saying, we want equality. And the people who have always been at the top are saying, no, if we give you equality, then we lose, which I personally don't believe is true. But I think it's one of the sort of tenets of the argument, if you will. Maybe that was a little wonky. Today
No, today we're speaking with Rachel Louise Snyder, about her new book. It's a very important book, No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. We have an email from Sandy who says, in 1981, I was the director of a battered women's shelter program based in Carson City, Nevada. Over and over, we encountered children of battered women who amplified the cycle of violence. They would hit their moms and their siblings because that's what they had seen. We addressed this on many fronts. I wrote a grant to get funding for a program directed at men who were batterers, envisioning group sessions and individual therapy. The grant process involved having interviews with county and state agencies to which we were applying. The consistent response was, while they lauded our vision, they denied funding our grant application because it was, quote, too radical. They had never seen such a program. And tragically, wasn't it the woman's fault? Sandy says, to your guest, how do anti-violence programs get funding?
Well, that was, you said 1981, right? So that, I mean, that is really innovative for that time period. That's before we even had a federal law against spousal abuse in this country. So kudos for her incredible futuristic vision. Batterers intervention groups get all kinds of funding. They get funding, funding from the Violence Against Women Act, which, as I talked to you today, has still not been reauthorized in the Senate, the 2018 Act. So call your senators and tell them to get on board and reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. They get state funding, and of course they get they also get paying. You know, there are people who just pay to attend their classes. So there's a variety of different funding. For example, in the San Bruno jail, their funding comes from through the sheriff's department through that budget, and they get state funding from that. So there's pockets of money, but it's even today, 40 years later, you know, we are almost chronically under-resourced when it comes to violence against women and how to treat it.
Well, thank you for calling, Sandy. Sandy also writes, I'm a retired Methodist minister. Then and now I have spoken about the role religion has played in shaping attitudes that support the abuse of women and the ways clergy have traditionally told women to put up with whatever is dished out to them. How does the religious backgrounds of the batterers inform their behavior?
That's a great question. So one of the things that researchers found with familicide, which is when someone kills their whole family and then kills themselves, it's pretty rare. But one of the things they found is that the roles tend to be very gendered in those homes. So women take on traditional roles of housekeeping and childcare, and men make, and that religion tends to be a big factor in those homes. So they're often very religious, very evangelical in this country. I would say that the religion doesn't always have a direct correlation when it comes to domestic violence, generally speaking. So that was a sort of subset of domestic violence, familicide. But I will say that research is showing that women will often go to their clergy or their you know, ministers or their reverends before they ever go to the police. And so one of the recommendations I make in the book is to have trauma-informed clergy to educate clergy about the dynamics of domestic violence, to have them be able to give resources to the people in their flock, as it were. Alongside that, of course, you have many religions that do espouse this very traditional view of femininity and what women are supposed to do and how they're supposed to act. And, you know, I had a conversation just this morning about the two men running for, I think they're both running for governors in Mississippi, who have refused to meet, be interviewed by female journalists if no one else is present. And that's the kind of fallback that patriarchy allows them. It allows them to use their religion and their sort of gendered patriarchal views to say, no, this is immoral. Of course, my perspective is that it is a weakness, their own weakness that is sort of causing them to fall back on that. But I think we need to push back wherever we can against these traditional views that keep women from being able to escape situations of abuse. When I was married, I myself was told, you know, to stay again and again. In my situation, I was not physically abused in my situation, but it, you know, that belief that, like, once you make a commitment, no matter what happens, you can't get out of it, no matter how bad it is. That, to me, seems like we're setting women on a particularly dangerous course with that philosophy.
Well, thank you so much for the email. And for listeners who maybe have not heard about these Republican candidates, I just wanted to read one from The Wrap. Mississippi Today reporter Larison Campbell said that GOP gubernatorial candidate Robert Foster's campaign denied her request to shadow him on a campaign event unless she was accompanied by a male campaign. He said that the campaign director, Colton Robinson, said he believed the optics of the candidate with a woman, even a working reporter, could be used in a smear campaign to insinuate an extramarital affair.
I guess you don't have much faith in your marriage then. I don't know. I mean, yeah. To me, that is a man who is afraid of the power of a woman. To me, that is just starkly a man who says, oh my gosh, I can't be in a room with a smart woman because she might oust me and I have too much ego. I think it's like, you know, what did AOC say about Trump? He fears us because we have power.
Right. There's also the stories about Mike Pence not wanting to be alone with another woman beside his wife in a room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same thing. Mike Pence, who's sort of all but disappeared from public life, it seems. Where is he? I don't know.
Maybe we should do a show about that. There's so much going on behind the scenes because of the horrific things that Trump is saying about race and the four women, and we will continue to do shows about what is going on behind the scenes. Let's try to get to a few more callers before we have to end. One other listener, Jackie in Oakland, wanted to give a shout out to a program called the Positive Discipline System, which is based on building respectful relationships at home and in the classroom. There are trainers in Santa Cruz, and it's positivediscipline.com. Thank you so much for that, Jackie. We will link to that at yourcallradio.org. We have time for one more caller. Let's go to Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. You know, my concern is that I'm very pleased that all of these shows have all women talking about women, and that they're in fact, if we're going to have any effect, I have no doubt. I've been an attorney, social worker, and worked with domestic violence for my entire career of 50 years plus. I see people legalize it and want to prosecute it. I've seen people want to therapize it and certainly politicize it. The bottom line is nobody really wants to talk about it, including women. They want to talk to themselves. Even in this discussion, it's been a binary framing of it, men versus women, male minds versus female minds. The whole question here about the rage that Ms. Snyder is talking about, her own, how does she manage that? And at some point, yes, we have a religious capitalist system where power and money speak. That's a problem for everybody, but we don't have any discussion. So until you have programs where you have someone on that will thoughtfully and caringly discuss the issue, and I don't mind just buying in.
Okay, Rich, Robert, we're almost out of time. What is missing from the conversation exactly?
Was that for me or for Robert?
I don't really understand what he's saying is missing from the conversation.
Well, I think he's making a really important and good point. And he's absolutely right that our discussion has been binary, that, you know, men are this way, women are this way, that men are the abusers, that women are the victims. And I think he's right to point out that, in fact, there's lots of different constellations, that women also have rage, that men also have vulnerability. The one thing I feel like I tell people, and I may have even said this last time I was on, is that I also agree with him that women don't talk about domestic violence. There is shame in being a victim. You know, we don't talk about it. I know, like, I have a friend who was killed June 7th, just this past year, you know, this past summer, by her husband. I think I may have cried last time I was on your show. It was so recent. We need to talk about it, and we need to normalize it in the same way that the Me Too movement has gotten women on social media and in their communities and in their workplaces. I mean, I'm a professor at American University. We had a whole meeting one day where just all of a sudden female professors began to talk about the things that had happened over their lives. He's right. We need to talk about domestic violence. Nothing will change. And part of how you bring down the power structures is naming them in the first place, I think.
Okay, I apologize. I thought he was referring to this conversation, and I thought this is what we've been doing the entire hour. So I apologize for that, Robert. I now understand what you're saying. Rachel,
I may have been misunderstanding it too. I may have been misunderstanding. I don't know. I'm always looking for connection.
Yeah, no, and I think that's right though, because I mean, if you don't have an hour to talk about this, it can be a pretty simplistic conversation. What else will it take, Rachel, to bring more of these, to get more funding for these kinds of programs that work? Because as you write, researchers found that once offenders from this Resolve to Stop the Violence program were released back into their communities, they became voices of nonviolence. What will it take to get more funding for these kinds of programs?
Boy, you know,
and we have about 30 seconds left.
Yeah. The very first thing we have to do is pass the 2018 reauthorization of VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act. That's number one. Number two, let's pass the Equal Rights Amendment. I would say those two things. Let's pass those two things, and then we'll get funding through those.
Well, we need very different politicians in office in order to do that. But yes, it
needs
to be.
Yes, we do. So vote in 2020. It comes out to that. Vote in 2020.
Continue talking about gerrymandering and voter suppression. Rachel Louise Snyder is author of No Visible Bruises, What We Don't Know About Domestic Violence Can Kill Us. Rachel, thank you again for coming back and for this, all the great work that you're doing and for writing this important book.
Thank you so much for having me. We are trying to solve the world's big problems here in 30 seconds or less, so I appreciate what you're doing, too.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.